The enemy is in charge in Kabul. There's no way else to describe that. That outcome is a cumulative effect of 20 years, not 20 days.
Top U.S. officials assess Afghanistan. It's Thursday, September 30th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online. You can find us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, difficulties leaving Hong Kong, firing up a cold debate, fear among Afghanistan's military women, cutting culinary waste while growing more food. It's all on today's VOA Asia. America's top military officer has described the Afghanistan evacuation as a logistical success, but a strategic failure. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, spoke at a contentious Senate hearing on the U.S. military's withdrawal and evacuation from Afghanistan. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has details.
The top U.S. general Tuesday bluntly assessing the Afghanistan evacuation mission.
It was a logistical success, but a strategic failure.
And the overall end of the war.
Outcomes in a war like this, an outcome that is a strategic failure. The enemy is in charge in Kabul. There's no way else to describe that. That outcome is the cumulative effect of 20 years, not 20 days.
Milley, along with Central Command Chief General Frank McKenzie, said they personally had wanted a minimum of 2,500 troops to remain.
My assessment was, back in the fall of 20, and it remained consistent throughout, that we should keep a steady state of 2,500, and it could bounce up to 3,500, maybe something like that, in order to move toward a negotiated, gated solution.
I recommended that we maintain 2,500 troops in Afghanistan. And I also recommended earlier in the fall of 2020 that we maintain 4,500 at that time. Those are my personal views. I also have a view that the withdrawal of those forces would lead inevitably to the collapse of the Afghan military forces and eventually the Afghan government.
The general's assertions contrasted with those of President Joe Biden, who has said he did not recall any of his advisors urging him to keep a small U.S. military force in Afghanistan. The White House Tuesday again defending the decision to remove all troops.
And if we had kept 2,500 troops there, we would have increased the number of troops, we would have been at war with the Taliban, we would have had more U.S. casualties. That was a reality everybody was clear-eyed about.
Both Republicans and Democrats slammed the administration for leaving Americans and Afghan allies behind after the president said he would not do so. They also asked pointed questions on the future of the counter-terror war there.
Has the military's task to defeat terror threats from Afghanistan gotten harder?
Yes.
Does the Taliban and its other terror partners have more ability to train and prepare in Afghanistan now that we've left?
More ability, yes.
Are you confident that we can deny organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS the ability to use Afghanistan as a launch pad for terrorist activity?
I think that's yet to be seen.
The military has come under harsh criticism for its errant drone strike in the final days of the withdrawal that killed 10 civilians, a strike for which McKenzie has taken responsibility. The top defense officials also reiterated that U.S. intelligence had failed to anticipate the rapid fall of Kabul. But in their lessons learned, they had a message for America's civilian leaders.
So I would advise any leader, don't put date certains on end dates. Make things conditions-based. Two presidents in a row put dates on it.
An ousted Afghan leader, Ashraf Ghani.
And when your president leaves suddenly in the middle of a campaign for the capital, I think that finishes any chance at all you might have had of making a stand there.
Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
Find out more about our top story by following us on Twitter at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And check us out at our website, voanews.com. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. India's elite military academy to open doors to women. Myanmar faces COVID vaccination woes as health system under threat. Taliban say they will use parts of monarchy constitution to run Afghanistan for now. Pakistani university manufactures stents for heart patients. New U.S.-India closeness angers Pakistan. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and so much more at Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and the voanews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Let's continue with VOA Asia. Concern is growing over the reach of China's so-called national security law that it recently imposed on Hong Kong. Britain warned several of its citizens that they could face arrest and extradition to the former British colony. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
China imposed the national security law on Hong Kong in June 2020 in response to anti-government protests, claiming it would restore order to the territory. Critics say it curtails basic democratic freedoms. Well over 100 people have been arrested under the legislation. Among them is opposition activist Andy Lee, who was charged with foreign collusion in 2020 after allegedly lobbying foreign governments to impose sanctions on Hong Kong and China. Several British citizens were named in the court papers. Earlier this month, the British government told them they could face arrest and extradition to Hong Kong if they travelled to any country that had an extradition agreement with the Chinese territory. Among them was US-born British citizen Bill Browder, who has campaigned globally for so-called Magnitsky sanctions against human rights abusers.
Specifically, my name was mentioned because I was having discussions with various people about Magnitsky sanctions against the Hong Kong officials who were involved in this suppression of democracy. After alerting me to my name being in the document, the Foreign Office officials pointed out to me that the Chinese national security law doesn't just apply domestically to residents of Hong Kong. It applies to anyone anywhere in the world.
Browder has already faced several attempts by Russia to have him arrested and extradited on fraud charges through Interpol, the global agency that communicates arrest warrants between police forces. Browder says the charges are clearly politically motivated.
I basically contain my travel to what I describe as rule of law countries. So, for example, I won't travel to South Africa, even though I actually own a home in South Africa, because it's not really considered to be a rule of law country. Whereas I would travel to Germany, regardless of what treaties they have, because I know that a German court will not hand me over to Russians or Chinese on politically motivated cases.
More than a dozen countries have extradition agreements with Hong Kong, including India, South Africa, and Portugal. British pro-democracy activist Luke de Pulford was also named in the Hong Kong court papers and approached by the British Foreign Office.
It's a really sad indictment and reflection on the UK's cowering before China. We're now in a situation that, having failed to honour their promises to the people of Hong Kong, the UK is telling people that they can't go to third countries because they might end up in prison.
Under the joint declaration signed between Britain and China before the 1997 handover of Hong Kong, Beijing promised to maintain the territory's autonomy under the so-called Basic Law. In a statement, the British government told VOA, "The UK will not look the other way on Hong Kong, and we will not duck our historic responsibilities to its people. As a co-signatory to the joint declaration, we will continue to stand up for the people of Hong Kong." Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Still ahead on VOA Asia, a fiery debate heats up. Happening now in Asia, North Korea state media says the latest missile test was a successful flight using newly developed hypersonic technology. South Korea President Moon Jae-in has ordered a detailed analysis of the North's latest actions. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for stopping by on this Thursday with us at VOA Asia. Australia is under growing international pressure to commit to net zero carbon emissions by the year 2050. But the policy is fiercely dividing its centre-right government. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia is one of the world's major exporters of coal and gas. Coal is mined in every Australian state. Most exports go to countries in Asia, including China, Japan and South Korea. In 2020, exports were worth about $39 billion. Trade has almost doubled in the past decade. But China's informal import restrictions on Australian coal saw the value of exports fall sharply, although prices have started to recover. Coal also generates about 70% of Australia's electricity. Coal-fired power makes it the most carbon-polluting nation per capita in the world. Prime Minister Scott Morrison is planning to eventually shift his country's reliance on coal and gas in favour of clean energy technologies, a shift from his time as Treasurer in 2017. In support of the mining industry, then-Treasurer Morrison brought a piece of coal to Parliament to argue the need to continue producing coal in a famous scene.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. It's coal that has delivered prosperity to Australian businesses and has ensured that Australian industry has been able to remain competitive on a global market.
Clean energy is still an issue that deeply divides his centre-right governing coalition. Some members of the National Party, the junior alliance partner, are adamant that Australia's coal industry is too valuable to lose and insist it will thrive for decades. Many regional communities depend on it. There's also disagreement about committing to a target of reaching net zero emissions by 2050. The Prime Minister said he wants to achieve net zero emissions as soon as possible, but hasn't outlined any measures to do so. But government lawmaker Trent Zimmerman says Australia must join the global push to reduce emissions.
We need both the target and the plan that matches it. It's very hard to divorce the two. And obviously, much of the international community has moved in that direction. In fact, 80% of global emissions or thereabouts are covered by pledges that relate to reaching net zero. So it is important for Australia that we are part of that because it's the right thing to do.
Morrison has said he's yet to decide whether he will attend the Glasgow Climate Change Conference, known as COP26, in November. He told a newspaper that he wanted to oversee Australia's eventual emergence from COVID-19 lockdowns. His critics insist he's too embarrassed by his government's climate change policies to attend the summit in the Scottish capital. Opinion polls by the Australia Institute, an independent public policy think tank based in Canberra, have shown that most Australians want stronger measures to curb emissions. A United Nations climate change report recently warned that global warming will inflict more severe and frequent drought, storms, heat waves, and bushfires in Australia. However, those surveys reported by the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper also revealed support for the coal industry. Less than half of Australians believe that coal power should be phased out within a decade. Australia's addiction to fossil fuels might be hard to give up, according to the survey. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You can read and see more on this story on Facebook at VOA Asia.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello anytime you're online or on your smartphone. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime.
This news from VOA Asia, Philippines presidential hopeful Manny Pacquiao has announced he is retiring from professional boxing after a decades-long career in the ring. Pacquiao described retiring as the hardest decision of his life. You'll find this and all the big stories through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue with VOA Asia. Women serving in the Afghan military say that they are worried about their safety and future under the Taliban. Yelda Bakhtash joins us with more details.
Mazari Amani, one of the few female generals in the Afghan army, was among those who fled Kabul on August 15, the day the Taliban entered the city. Amani, who is now in France, says that she's worried about the safety of her female colleagues still in Afghanistan. Many of these women have said they fear for their lives now that the militants are in control of the country.
Some of the women who contact me say that the Taliban are searching for them, carrying out night raids of their houses, getting biometrics. They say they are not in their houses, and they do not know how long they will be hiding in the houses of others.
Amani says that she receives dozens of calls each day from her female colleagues.
They want me to help to raise their voice to the world that their lives are in danger.
Despite the Taliban's assurances that they will allow women to work outside their homes, the female soldiers want the international community to exert pressure on the militant group.
My demand from the international community and the U.S. is to get guarantees from the Taliban that they stand by their pledges.
But some women do not believe the Taliban will change their position on women, particularly those in uniform.
The Taliban point of view toward women is that they do not accept women participating at any level, particularly if you're a military woman. What do you think the Taliban would offer in this regard?
Thousands of women were serving in the security sector in Afghanistan before the Afghan government collapsed. Many women's rights activists are concerned that the gains made by women in the past two decades in Afghanistan are at risk now that the Taliban are back in power. Yelda Bakhtash, VOA News, Washington.
Making headlines in Asia, Fumio Kishida has been elected as the new leader of Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party. That sets him on a course to become the country's next prime minister. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, China recently enacted a wide-ranging law aimed at reducing food waste. The law includes fines of up to $15,000 against broadcasters and streaming services that show content promoting binge eating. The law, in response to President Xi Jinping's calls for greater food security, is also aimed at restaurants, as Chinese hosts often order excessive amounts of food as a way to show hospitality. In the United States, food waste awareness is growing, but not in the same ways as in China. Arlington County, which is across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C., is now the first county in the state of Virginia to collect food scraps from single-family households. The aim is to reduce household waste ending up in landfills, as Lilia Anisimova tells us in this story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Since the beginning of September, every Arlington County resident can get rid of their food scraps, both for free and for the greater good.
We actually provided every resident with what we called a starter kit. And the starter kit basically was a food caddy storage container. And inside, we provided them with 20 compostable bags and just information. And the information had a letter which basically introduced the program. And then we basically had a how-to food scraps guide, which showed people step-by-step really how to execute from when you have raw food, actually put in your caddy with a bag, and then moving the bag to your green organics cart that actually is taken to the curb and the trash crews actually remove.
A county government survey shows 90% of residents support such green initiatives, but it can be complicated. Officials say that even well-intentioned people throw food scraps into the wrong containers by mistake, which makes the sorting process a lot more difficult. This program should help. Food scraps make up some 20% of all household waste, and this new program will prevent it from going to landfills or garbage incineration plants. That means less methane emissions, a drop in carbon emissions, and saving energy. Another major advantage is that food waste is transformed into organic fertilizers.
What we do is we basically get food that's brought in the green cart, and we will tip it in here. I'm not sure why it's open, they must be doing something. But if you look inside here, we actually match the food scraps with some other carbon, like wood chips and other things. And then this auger turns and moves the material back and forth. And so at the end, you'll see where it's darker and just more mixed material. But that's what ultimately becomes the compost.
Arlington County works closely with Free State Farms, a site that transforms food and yard waste into high-quality compost, renewable energy, and organic produce, and then later provides local parks, gardens, and schools with the valuable material.
So the construct is we want to remove as much food scraps from going to the incinerator to a compost facility, make as much compost as we can to make and regenerate soil.
The county adopted a zero-waste resolution back in 2015, with the hope that by 2038, the amount of waste going into the incinerator will drop to some 10%, while 90% will be recycled.
It's really an aspirational goal. It's hard to get to 90%. Our current recycling rate is slightly over 50% right now. So to get from 50 to 90 is a long haul, but there are things we can do.
And as Arlington County gets closer to its eco-friendly goal, they hope the rest of the state and then the country will follow suit, one recycling bin at a time. For Lilia Anisimova in Arlington, Virginia, Anna Rice, VOA News.
As efforts to cut food waste continue, the other side of the equation is to grow more food in responsible ways. A student program that teaches organic gardening skills started in Los Angeles and has now spread across the United States and into 26 other countries. Mike O'Sullivan reports its projects impart an environmental message.
Planting lettuce, kale, radishes, artichokes, and herbs at this school in Inglewood, California, these kids are getting an introduction to gardening.
Oh, this is an excellent experience for our kids. Already this morning, they've kind of learned the difference between dirt and soil and what are we going to be doing in our garden and how we're going to harvest the fruits and vegetables that we're planting. So it's a very exciting time for them.
Soil, as opposed to dirt, is rich with living organisms and nutrients. And these students are learning to rely on natural growing methods using helpful insects such as ladybugs to keep away pests. This program, called Grades of Green, started 12 years ago at another school.
And four moms really just wanted to, you know, bring education and awareness of the environment to their school and their students. And the kids were so excited because they were doing project-based learning, just like this.
It has spread to many places.
We are in multiple countries in Africa, Cameroon, Nigeria. We're in India also. We've been in Italy, Costa Rica.
Among supporters, a family-owned company that produces organic soil and fertilizer. The founder's granddaughter says one important benefit of gardening is
the confidence that comes from being able to garden and harvest something that you planted from seed and to nurture it.
Spending time in the garden teaches students about the environment.
So our real goal is that we're building the next generation of environmental leaders that are going to take care of our planet, not just for themselves and for us, of course, but for all the future generations.
It's a hands-on experience that conveys a bigger message. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
We're glad you've been able to spend part of your morning with us at VOA Asia. Continue online. We're at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Look us up under our name, VOA Asia. We thank our team, Service Chief Diane Gao, Keith Lane, and Chris Cascao. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.